From WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, October 1st. Ron DeSantis wants to make signature gathering for constitutional amendment petitions more difficult. During an appearance in Orlando yesterday, the governor said the current rules incentivize fraud. Supporters for constitutional amendments already face stringent requirements. DeSantis has agitated against two proposed amendments, one that guarantees access to abortion and another one that allows recreational use of marijuana, that cleared the hurdle of nearly 900,000 signatures. The Florida legislature recently banned the long-standing practice of paying petition gatherers according to the number of signatures they get. Petition gatherers also are now required to identify themselves and to register with the state. One petitioner gatherer was recently arrested amid an investigation by the state's Office of Election Crimes. A national ranking of New College of Florida took a hit for the second year in a row. In this year's U.S. News & World Report Liberal Arts College Ranking, the Sarasota school reached number 122. That's 22 spots lower than in 2023, when it had dropped 24 spots. The school has been undergoing a conservative transformation since early 2023. The college's administrators plan to ask for more than $200 million from the Florida University System's Board of Governors over the next 5 years to facilitate that change. Manatee County has released the first damage reports from Hurricane Helene. Flooding from storm surge destroyed 542 homes and damaged more than 2,000. The county estimates the total residential damage at $354 million. Relief efforts are now pivoting towards assessing the needs of residents. The county is seeking volunteers for that. The most affected areas are the Barrier Islands, the mostly African-American community of Rubonia, and trailer parks throughout the county. One more piece of recovery info. Manatee County reminds residents that it is illegal to dump sand cleared from private property on the beach. That is supposed to prevent that nails, debris, oil, bleach, or fertilizer end up on the beaches. There is no solution yet. County leaders are in talks with local cities and towns what to do with the sand on private property. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, October 1st.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 46 of Our Changing Environment and is being recorded on October 1st, 2024. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and we're assisted today by Alvaro Montalegre.
Our guest today is Dr. Dave Tomasco, director of the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program.
The views, comments, and opinions that come from our interviews, shows, on-air personalities, and from our calling guests are uncensored. And those views and opinions can be widespread and extremely diverse. The opinions or views expressed by same do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WSLR, our staff, or volunteers.
Dave, we're honored to have you here with us today. And we have a bunch of questions to discuss with you.
Happy to be here.
And some of them are related to the recent events of Hurricane Helene, but also others are about your history with the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program. And can you just start by describing the area, the geographic area of the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program?
Sure. Sarasota Bay Estuary Program covers an area from, say, Anna Maria Island all the way down to Venice Inlet. It's about 50 square miles of open water, and it's about 150 square miles of watershed. So the land that drains into it is about three times bigger than the bay itself. And it includes Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key, City of Sarasota, Manatee County, Sarasota County. So we're actually not, you know, of the four National Estuary Programs in Florida, we're the smallest one in terms of the open water. We're the smallest one in terms of the watershed, but we're actually the most densely populated people per square mile. We have more people per square mile in our watershed than Biscayne Bay, about three times as many people per square mile as Tampa Bay. So that geography is mostly urbanized, not an awful lot of open land in our watershed.
You abut both Tampa Bay Estuary Program to the north and the Central Heartland.
Coastal and Heartland.
Coastal
yeah.
Heartland
yeah.
Estuary Program to the south.
Yeah. We've had actually, one of the nice things that we've learned is that things that happen outside of our boundaries definitely affect us. So in 2021, right around April, we had the Piney Point disaster, and that absolutely affected us to the northern part of Sarasota Bay, at least, Anna Maria Sound down to probably around Cortez. We had macroalgal blooms like we'd not had in decades. And we actually are also strongly influenced by red tides that are made worse by the Caloosahatchee River discharges. So things that happen in our watershed affect our water quality, but things that happen outside of our watershed affect our water quality as well. We've learned that from Piney Point, and we learn that every time the Caloosahatchee River makes a red tide worse.
So I'm so old, I can remember when the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program had an N stuck in there. It was the National Estuary Program. So what happened there, and how did it affect things?
So the estuary programs were modeled after the Chesapeake Bay program. They're an EPA program. And when the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program was originally formed, it was a Sarasota Bay National Estuary Program because it was within the National Estuary Programs. They give us a lot of flexibility. So a lot of people may not know this, but we're actually a special independent district, you know, in the state of Florida. So we're de facto state employees. But 70 to 80% of our funding comes from the federal government, and the rest of our funding comes from local governments, Sarasota County, Manatee County, City of Sarasota, Town Longboat Key, City of Bradenton. So it's kind of like a strange little entity that was set up by the EPA, but they did that on purpose. They gave us a lot of flexibility of like who would manage us, because what they want is a locally driven, science-based management plan to deal with all the issues that every estuary has. And our problems are different than Indian River Lagoon. It's different than Morro Bay, California. It's different than Casco Bay. So they give us a lot of flexibility about how to organize ourselves and how to like figure out our management paradigms.
So the estuary programs have these checkpoints. They have a comprehensive management plan.
Yeah.
The CCMP, and then every 5 years you need to update your management plans with actions and goals and objectives. And that's a real partnership kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and we they give us a little bit of flexibility. I think it's, you know, something like 5 to 7 years, depending upon how much things have changed. But yeah, we finished our last one in 2022. And it has some of the same themes as what we had in our first one, which is in 1995. But there are some differences. And one of the things that we're really stressing in the last couple of years is climate change is something we've talked about like in the 90s, but it's now what we're living through. And so to us, one of the big problems that we've tried to like make people aware of is, you know, we've got three major kind of stresses: population growth, aging infrastructure, and now climate change. And climate change is making our infrastructure even more vulnerable than it would have been otherwise. So we can't manage our bay based upon what worked 30 years ago because our weather is already changing. And, you know, we've had two 100-year rain events in the last 2 years. And in June of this year, we had the highest hourly rainfall event in 50 years of record. So, you know, how often are we going to have, you know, rain events that we keep saying are so rare, they're 100-year rain events? We're trying to manage our infrastructure with a rainfall data set that actually doesn't seem all that relevant anymore. And I think that's the biggest difference in the last couple of years versus what we talked about in the 90s.
So let's unpack a little bit how climate change has affected planning in this region, especially for the estuary programs. It seems like there's more intense rainfall, right?
Yeah, it seems to be, yes.
And then the warmer water creates more storm surge. Is that right?
Yeah, our sea level rise data, you know, we've got data that goes back about 100 years, and it averaged about an inch a decade. The last 20 years, it's been 3 inches a decade. And it appears that the rate of sea level rise is higher than what we've had at any time over the last 2,000 to 5,000 years. So it's not unprecedented. 20,000 years ago, we had even higher rate of sea level rise when we came out of the last glacial maximum. But we had humans, certainly, on this planet hundreds of thousands of years ago, but we haven't had, like, the traditional defined civilization. So if you say, you know, hey Siri, hey Google, what's the oldest civilization? They're going to give you the Sumerians in Mesopotamia. And that's 5,000 years ago. And over the last 5,000 years, we've had sea level rise around an inch a decade, and now it's 3 inches a decade. And so the warmer water is expanding upwards. And so it's not even Greenland melting yet. It's really just thermal expansion. So sea level rise is coming up. That's a stress, more intense rain. When you combine both of those with, you know, a warmer Gulf of Mexico, warmer moisture air, it's going to be more fuel for powerful hurricanes that are occurring with a higher water level, with the intensity of rain increasing as well. So that's a real stress. I'm not sure how we get through it, because we've never gone through it before.
And the other thing is that we don't have cold nights anymore. And that means that the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico and the bottom of our bays are not getting that cold layer in the winter anymore, and that allows more tropical species to expand northward, both in the Gulf of Mexico and also in our local bays. Is that right?
Yeah, one of the noticeable things that people see is that upside-down jellyfish, which used to be fairly rare 30 years ago, I mean, they're scientific name is Cassiopeia zamacana, and zamacana basically refers to Jamaica, which is where it was first originally identified. So these upside-down jellyfish, which act a little bit like corals, are now really common, and I don't remember seeing them 30 years ago. But they're,
right. You had to go down to the Keys to see them.
Yeah, you go down to the Keys to see them, and now we have snook up in Cedar Key. We have mangroves in Georgia. And like Julie was saying, it's not necessarily that it's getting hotter and higher temperatures. That's happening. But it's just not getting that cold anymore. Right. We don't have freezes. And so mangroves are expanding northwards because they're not held in check by freezes anymore.
Do we have lionfish now?
We have lionfish offshore. Okay. Yeah, we have lionfish offshore. I don't know if we have them in the bay, but I know we have them offshore.
Okay.
Well, and mangroves are replacing what used to be salt marshes.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you've been to Homosassa River, like, you know, decades ago, go out there now in the Black Needle Rush marshes, which were gorgeous. They look like, you know, the Glynn County, Georgia marshes. Yeah. It's all mangroves. It could just as well be the Everglades, which is beautiful, but it's not what that place used to be not that long ago.
Well, and up in that Big Bend area, we're seeing the cabbage palms are dying. They're 150-year-old, 200-year-old cabbage palms are dying, and there's no replacement taking place.
But that's because of rising sea level.
I understand. Okay. But you combine it. In other words, if you look at a Winslow Homer painting of that area then and now, you would see the mangroves have replaced the marsh, and the palms that were there are dead. So it's a pretty dramatic switcheroo.
Yeah, the tropicalization of, you know, our environment. And it's not something that people are completely, you know, aware of, but like an FAU poll that was done recently concluded that 90% of Floridians believe in climate change, and about 70% think the state should do more about it.
And, well, we are. We're making it illegal to mention it in any legislation. You can't say we haven't done anything. We're leaders in denying its existence.
To me, it's sort of like there is money from the state to, like, harden your house. That's a good idea. Yeah. There is money for, like, making our communities more resilient. But, like, we don't talk about the causes of it. And to me, it's a little bit silly. It's sort of like putting all your money into cures when someone gets lung cancer rather than telling people smoking makes lung cancer much more likely. And so we're not acting upon why we have to be resilient. We're just making ourselves more resilient.
I try to go to the legislative delegation meetings each year, and it's really common for people to show up from Longboat Key and ask for money to deal with rising sea level or climate change effects on Longboat Key. I mean, they're aware of these issues. It's just not getting through to the legislature.
I think it's going to just take a little bit more time. You know, I mean, personally, I think that when we start abandoning parts of Florida over the next, I think, 10 years, North Key Largo is my bet. You know, Stillwell Point, North Key Largo is going to be uninhabitable in, like, probably about 10 years, I think. Not that you couldn't live there, but you can't get to your house, you know. And I think when we start seeing people saying, I'm not going to live with this, not necessarily the tropical storms, but, like, the day-to-day flooding when it rains on a high tide, I think that's when people are going to start taking it seriously. So I think we need this, like, bridge over the next 10 years where we can act on resiliency, and then maybe within 10 years we'll have a legislature that reflects the average person, which believes in climate change and believes that humans are playing a role in it.
So in this last Helene, we started seeing reports from Hillsborough and Manatee of a lot of either lift station or sewage plant failures. What was the situation down here?
We had quite a bit. Bradenton's wastewater treatment plant was actually more stressed by Debbie than Helene.
Okay.
And that's really a function of the very old infrastructure. You know, the pipes are 50, 70 years old. Some of them are like clay, you know, like the pots that you put in your front yard kind of a thing. And but that's actually one of the kind of good things. So, like, in 2013 to 2019, we had a billion gallons of partially treated or raw wastewater that came into our bay, mostly from Sarasota County. And after Debbie, I think it was down to less than a million gallons. And after this one, I'm not quite sure what we've had, but I get these reports, and they're not flaring up as much as they were in the past.
Okay.
So explain how heavy rainfall and high water table makes it so that millions of gallons of untreated wastewater are released to the bays.
Yeah, and that's why I think Debbie was worse than what Helene just brought us, because Debbie caused us, like, you know, more than 10 inches of rain, you know, across this huge area. It was, you know, probably hundreds of billions of gallons of rainfall. And it soaks into the ground, and your pipes are like 50, 70 years old. So it's called infiltration inflow. So the wastewater comes through the through the tops of the manhole covers. But mostly what happens is the pipe is meant to be in kind of dry-ish ground. But instead, if the water table is up at the surface, if you see flooded streets, that means your ground is saturated, which means the pipes are just going to have every little crack, every little joint is going to be a way for water to get in. So Bradenton's wastewater treatment plant had like three times as much water coming into it as what they could handle. And so the whole system kind of crashed. They went septic, which means there was no oxygen in the wastewater treatment plant. And you need oxygen because a wastewater treatment plant has to have bacteria that break down the stuff. Once you screen, you know, stuff out, then you have these larger particles, and they have to be broken down by the bacteria. And the bacteria were gone because the whole thing went septic, no oxygen because of too much water that came in. The filters clogged, and that's why they had the overflows. But, you know, with Helene, we didn't really have that much rainfall, and so we didn't have that same stress. So we had some failures. I live in Palmetto, and we had wastewater overflows rain in my street. But it wasn't as bad as it was after, like, Debbie.
Debbie in early August,
So if we were rethinking things, we might put the wastewater piping above ground.
Yeah, well, they always have wastewater treatment plants. You know, they were built traditionally on the lowest elevation, that's how a gravity-fed system works.
Right.
So you run it down towards the bay, which is where a lot of the wastewater treatment plants are.
Yeah.
But I do think like Sarasota County doing a lot better with Debbie and with Helene than was the case, you know, 10, 15 years ago. That's kind of a good news because...
Well, what are some other good news? You've been around long enough to be able to tell us any of the positive trends we're seeing in our bay systems.
Yeah, so right now it seems kind of like weird to talk about good news in the bay's water quality.
We can get to the rest.
But there is some, yeah.
We can get to the rest, but there is some good news.
Yeah, we so these investments, you know, our local governments have already invested over $300 million into wastewater upgrades. We had a Bobby Jones, if you've been to there recently, that is a stormwater treatment system, Nature Park, that treats 5,000 acres of an area that didn't have stormwater treatment. So these big stormwater retrofit, there's also one in Hudson Bayou. We've been doing a lot of neighborhood retrofits of stormwater ponds. We've been doing a lot of habitat restoration projects. And so we were seeing really good trends in water quality. So over the last, say, from 2020 to 2023, our water quality has improved sufficiently that...
In the bay. Okay.
In the bay. That from... We no longer have any of the open waters of Sarasota Bay that are impaired for nutrients, which might sound weird to people, but that's what the data shows. It's very clear. The investments that have been made on wastewater and stormwater are paying off. The water quality is better now. It just is. Than it has been, like, say, during the period of 2013 to 2019. So that's good news. But, you know, now we've got, like, tropical storm events and then the big June rainfall event. We'll see what it does for 2024.
And we may have shifting expectations or baseline. People may look at it now and say, well, this is terrible, but they forget what it was like previously.
Yeah, 2018, 2019, you had like Riverview High School, hundreds of people because the water quality was so bad. And it is better. And I think people tend to get a little bit, what would be the right word? They tend to not pay as much attention when things are good as when they're bad.
Well.
And I think that's kind of bad because for us to continue to make these improvements, we have to make sure that people don't release the pressure to do the right things.
Well, it's good enough right now.
Yeah.
We've come a long way. We don't need to do much more.
So I read in the Tampa Bay Times this slogan that Tampa Bay is hotter and fresher.
Yeah.
Is that true also in the Sarasota Bays?
It appears to be. They have a better, longer-term data set than we have.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a set monitoring program. They've been going to the same locations, you know, every month since the 70s. And we don't have that. We've changed our monitoring programs. It's not necessarily every month. And we have people who measure water temperature every 15 minutes, but they've not been doing it for decades. And we have people who have been measuring for decades, but at different locations, but it does appear that we're getting warmer. The funny thing, and it gets back to your earlier comment, even in Tampa Bay, it's not like it's getting hotter in the summer. It's just not getting as cool in the wintertime. And so high temperatures in the summer will reduce how much oxygen you can hold in the water, and that's a real problem for fish kills in the morning. But warmer temperatures in the winter could be one of the reasons why we're seeing more algal blooms of certain types because, and there's no magic number. We don't have the numbers yet. But like if, for example, 68 degrees Fahrenheit is a temperature that allows Lingbia, or it's actually called Dapis pleosa now, Lingbia to grow, then we used to have 9 months out of the year where it was warmer than 68, and now we have 10 months out of the year. And so what if it never gets below 68? Then you won't have a 10-month algae growing season, and you could have a 10-year growing season. And so warmer temperatures can make warmer temperatures and eutrophication or artificially increasing nutrient loads are thought to be two things that would make cyanobacteria blooms more common in Florida's coastal waters, according to Valerie Paul with the Smithsonian.
Well, so talk about Lingbia. When I first started going out in the bays around here, I either didn't know how to recognize it or it wasn't here. What is Lingbia and what's its defining characteristics?
It's It's now called DAPHIS.
DAPHIS.
Well, I hear that.
DAPHIS Pleasa.
DAPHIS.
Well, I don't. I'm going to call it Lingvia.
You know, other common names are snotgrass. Can I say that?
That's helpful, yes.
Mermaid's hair. It's a cyanobacteria, which means it's really an ancient organism. They're the organisms that have been around longer than anything else, billions of years. You're not going to make it go away.
Okay.
They actually probably created the oxygen in the atmosphere that allow us to live. But what Lingvia needs is it needs warmer water and fairly clear water. It doesn't grow. When you see those mats of Lingvia on the surface of the water, that's kind of near the end of their life cycle. They start their life cycle growing as an epiphyte attached to the seagrass meadows. And then as the water starts to warm, then their metabolism can go up. And then they start to proliferate. And that's when they break off at the surface. They're kind of driven up to the surface of the water by all the oxygen bubbles, and then it's rafted on. And when it decomposes, it smells just horrible. I mean, it smells awful. It's got these compounds in it that are similar to rotting meat.
Okay.
And that's not a good thing. And it's not a good thing to actually, like, let your dog – I mean, dogs die sometimes if they eat Lingvia. So you got to keep dogs away, horses away. And it causes contact dermatitis, so it makes your skin itch like you've
ever. So it's nasty.
Yeah. I mean, we were in – after Piney Point, we were snorkeling these transects trying to quantify it, and your just skin would just tingle like you're up in an attic rolling around in fiberglass okay. insulation. It was just not fun.
Great image, yeah.
So I want to get back to the fresher part.
Yeah.
It seems like the watershed for Sarasota Bay has been connected with all of these channels and canals that move water more quickly from the landscape to the bay. And so is that historically was Sarasota Bay less fresh? It was more closer to
marine.
It was closer to marine.
Kind of depends on where you are.
Okay.
So like in the upper bay, the watershed to water ratio is kind of close to 1 to 2 to 1. So in other words, it's about a square mile of land that drains into a square mile of open water. In the lower bay, it's around 10 to 1. So in the lower bay, it probably was always a more estuarine kind of environment. And in the upper bay, it was probably more of a marine environment. And that means you can't expect the lower bay to look like the upper bay. It probably didn't look like the upper bay 150, 200 years ago. So we're trying to make each bay segment as healthy as it can be based upon where it's located. But yeah, it kind of depends on where you are for the most part.
Okay, that's great. You are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. WSLR in Fogartyville invite listeners, neighbors, and first-timers to Many Voices, One Community, our annual open house on Saturday, October 5th. That's this Saturday from 5 to 9 p.m. The evening includes performances by Los Rumberos and the Barker Project, as well as sets from DJ Milo from Milo After Hours on WSLR and Flashback Frequencies featuring DJ Nomad of Synth World on WSLR and DJ Mondays. Plus, we'll have tours of the radio station, food trucks, CD sale, nonprofit partners, and celebration cake. More information about WSLR and Fogartyville's Many Voices, One Community Open House on October 5th at WSLR.org or by calling 941-894-6469.
Florida voters, wonder if you have the right photo ID? You must bring an unexpired photo ID that has your signature on it, like a Florida driver's license or state ID. If your photo ID has no signature, be prepared with an additional ID that does have your signature. To learn more or for free help getting an ID to vote, call or text to Vote Writers Helpline at 866-ID-2, that's the numeral, VOTE, V-O-T-E, or go to voteriders.org.
Okay, so Tell us about seagrass trends. And we don't know, because of the intense rainfall events of this summer, how that will affect the trends of seagrass yet. We don't know that yet.
Right. The seagrass maps are produced every 2 years by our partners with the Water Management District. And it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. It's like you have to have the right tide level, you have to have the right cloud cover, you have to have the right sun angle, water clarity has to be right, then the plane has to be available. And and that actually, sometimes we did not get the most ideal conditions to fly it earlier this year. But our 2024 maps, the numbers should come out in 2025. But we believe that the number is going to be a big increase. We peaked in around 2016, then we went down to 2018 in the lower bay. We had declines that started back around then, back when we had the worst of the water quality in the lower bay. And then the big decline we had acreage-wise was in response to that 2017 to 2019 red tide. So we lost a lot of seagrass, like about 2,000 acres or so in the upper part of the bay between 2018 and 2020. 2020 to 2022, we only lost about 5%, which is normally not good, but it was really good because we were down like 18% the time before that. And so this year, we're expecting a pretty substantial increase. The water clarity has been good. Our former scientist, Jay Leveroni, who just retired Friday, and I have been monitoring a couple of stations, and we found seagrass in most of the locations where we'd lost it between 2018 and 2020 now has seagrass. And in fact, it was there in 2022. It just wasn't dense enough to be picked up from an airplane.
Yeah.
So we think the 2024 numbers are going to be pretty good, which is an expectation because the water clarity is definitely better than it was 2017 to 2019. So the water quality is getting better. The seagrasses are coming along and recovering. And that's just good news, we think, for the bay, because seagrasses do so much good for us. And the kind of worst case scenario about what happens when seagrasses are lost is like the Indian River Lagoon, where they might have lost, you know, half of their manatees from starvation. We're not seeing that where we are. So that's our last bit of information that should come out in early of next year, which is how much seagrass do we have. But we're anticipating, my personal bet is it's going to be about 800 acre increase. And I hope I'm wrong on the upside.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's going to be at least 800 acres. That's what I think we're going to see.
So we've talked about some of the trends. Let's talk about some of the acute specifics. And what are you seeing specifically or anticipate effects of Helene?
So it's going to be unusual because I think Helene might be actually not as problematic as Debbie because we don't have the big runoff.
Right.
We just had storm surge. And then, you know, I would not go swimming on the beaches anytime soon because of all the debris, all the cars and all that other stuff. But the bay's water quality, if you go out on the bay now, it doesn't look as bad as it did after Debbie. And we're not going to go out and sample because we don't want to stress all the resources. We'll gather the data as it comes in on a regular monitoring. But after Debbie and after Ian, we went out and sampled because it looked so bad. After this event, it looks really turbid, but we didn't have the huge amount of stormwater runoff. So we'll see. But this might be like a supercharged version of Idalia. And after Idalia, the water looked bad for a little while, but it wasn't that bad that long. So we'll see.
Okay, so can you explain to our listeners how runoff and water quality affects seagrass acreage in the bays?
Sure. So there's nothing natural about our watershed. And so if you're a raindrop and you're falling from the sky, you're going to hit a rooftop, a driveway, a parking lot, an overfertilized lawn, a golf course, or something. You're not going to hit a natural landscape unless you land down in, like, you know, Oscar Sheer. That's it. And what it does is it means when it does rain, you get this runoff that includes, like, you know, dog poop and over-fertilized lawns and all the vegetation gets blown down during a storm event. And that will bring nutrients that will make the algae grow faster. So, like, if you add nitrogen and phosphorus to make your lawn look green, it'll make your lawn look green. It'll make your bay look green, too. If you want your tree to grow faster, it also makes algae grow faster. So more nutrients make more intense algal blooms, pretty much. And that's why we're paying so much attention to wastewater and stormwater retrofits to reduce that nutrient load. But it does another thing, particularly in the lower bay, which is if you have enough water, it forms a layer of fresher water on top of the saltier water underneath, and that's called salinity stratification. And when you have fresh water or fresh to brackish water on top of saltier water, then the bottom doesn't get oxygen. And so we've seen that particularly in Little Sarasota Bay after Ian and after Debbie, the bottom of Little Sarasota Bay went anoxic for a couple of weeks. And if you're a big fish, you just swim away. I mean, it was fantastic for tarpon. There were tarpon all over the place, eating the little crabs that swim up to the surface to get some oxygen. But if you're a small fish or a crab or a worm or a starfish or a ray, then you can't get away from it. So that lower part of the bay is particularly susceptible to oxygen problems when you get a big rain event.
So do I understand correctly that the county health people sample the beaches for water quality and you know, fecal contamination, but they don't do that in our bay?
No, that's right. Well, they do some spots. And I'm not sure if it's a county or a Department of Health that may actually delegate that to the county. But Department of Health actually has a website, Healthy Beaches. And you can look at, it's not just Lido and, you know, Coquina. They also sample at Bird Key. And they sample at the south side of Palmasola Causeway, for example. But they sample at what they call bathing beaches. So they don't sample at like boat ramps and marinas. They sample at places that are like...
Right, but they're probably not sampling at Indian Beach or at New College where people wade into the water.
No, those places, those are actually being sampled by Suncoast Waterkeepers. So Suncoast Waterkeepers is actually kind of filling in a data gap, which is where the places where it's not a bathing beach, but people access the water. And they actually, we link to their website on our website. You can go to Suncoast Waterkeepers, or you can go to our website and take that link to Suncoast Waterkeepers for that data set.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Little Sarasota Bay. You were saying that it's especially vulnerable to this stratification, and so it may get worse. The conditions there may get worse than in other parts of the bay. But I'm reminded when I was a kid, we would go hunting in the marshes in New Jersey, and my father walked me out to a point, and there was like a marshy island. And at the far end of the island, there was a place where there was a little row of floating marsh sedges or rushes. I don't know what they were. And he pointed that to me. And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "That's where the tide comes from two directions and meets here. And stuff that falls in here, it doesn't go this way and it doesn't go that way. It's just sort of stuck there." And that's part of the Little Sarasota Bay MO, is that it's sort of hydrologically equidistant from Venice Inlet and Big Pass?
Yeah, it's called a null zone for circulation. So the tide will come in. There's still tidal influence in Little Sarasota Bay. It's not all fresh water. It's not all salt water.
And it's
a mixture.
It's not stagnant.
It's not stagnant. It doesn't have it has a longer residence time than it used to.
Okay.
It used to have about maybe a 60-70% water exchange in 10 days. Now it's a 27% since the pass has been closed. And what that means is that whether it's stormwater runoff or whether it's material that's brought in from Philippi Creek, when it rains a lot and Philippi Creek is discharging, if it's an incoming tide, that water is moving to the south into Little Sarasota Bay. So Philippi Creek doesn't just affect Roberts Bay, it affects Little Sarasota Bay as well.
Okay.
And as it gets in there, it just hangs around longer because it's got a long residence time. And that kind of like is probably one of the reasons why you get that strong stratification there. So the worst water quality that we saw after Ian, for example, was Little Sarasota Bay, even though the watershed is not that big, because it's kind of influenced by things to the south and things to north, because when the tide comes in, the inflow from Venice Inlet and the inflow from Big Pass, New Pass meet basically in Little Sarasota Bay. It's called a null zone.
Okay. So does that also apply then with a red tide event?
Yeah. When we had that really bad red tide, 2017 going into 2019, we had red tide in Little Sarasota Bay, but it was much less intense there than most other parts of the bay. Certainly wasn't nearly as bad as what we had off of like St. Armand's.
So there are certain life stages of particular marine and estuarine organisms that like the Little Sarasota Bay conditions. Is that right?
Yeah, Little Sarasota Bay and Palmasola Bay. So our fish populations are sampled by researchers from Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and they go out and drag nets. There's basically two different types right now, big seines that are a boat goes and lays it out, or a seine that like two people will walk it through. It's exhausting work. I did it one day, and I just went home, took a bath, drank a beer, and was asleep at 8 o'clock. And it's tough work. But what they find is that in terms of the number of fish per effort, the one and two going back and forth of the five bay segments are Palmasola Bay and Little Sarasota Bay. So Little Sarasota Bay is there's loads of fish there. There's 600 acres of seagrass. It's a great place to see manatees. And there's lots of fish there. The fish are smaller. It's a nursery for the most part, but it's not exclusively a nursery. So the majority of the reason why there's so many fish per effort is anchovies. But anchovies are eaten by bigger fish. It's not just anchovies. The researchers have found redfish and snook and sea trout, and there's loads of gray snapper out there. There's loads of sheep's head. It's not dead at all. It's different, but it's not dead at all. But it does, after a big rain event, exhibit a problem of that salinity stratification bottom water hypoxia that's worse than anywhere else in our bay.
So explain that to our listeners. Freshwater is less dense, and so it floats on top of the denser salt water. So explain that.
Yeah, so imagine like if you go to the beach sometimes and like it's warm on the surface and then it's colder when you swim down the bottom.
Yeah. Lakes are like that.
Yeah, lakes are like that. That's driven by that density difference there is driven by temperature, but it can also be driven by salinity. So fresher water comes in such a massive amount that it doesn't mix with the saltier water, so it forms a little bit of a lens. And that means the bottom is not going to be getting oxygen from the atmosphere because it's isolated by this layer of water on top of it. And it's not going to get oxygen from photosynthesis because it's too dark. Because, you know, after a big rain event, the water is very tanniny looking. It's like swamp water. Mm-hmm. And so you got no oxygen, you got no atmospheric, and you have a lot of organic material that's been brought in, and it's going to decompose. So it's like an underwater compost heap in the dark. And that will drive the oxygen levels low, and that is a problem. If that only happened every decade or so, big deal. But if it happens like twice a year or every year, then that's a problem.
So you should tell our listeners, you periodically on the Bay Program website, you have like director's insights or comments. I forget what you call it.
Notes.
Director's notes.
Director's notes.
So can you tell people how to access that and what your, I think your most recent one is you walked down to Midnight, we got to Midnight Pass somehow. Talk about how to access that and what you found.
Yeah, so if you go to our website, sarasotabay.org, or we're actually also on Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn. If you go to our website, sarasotabay.org, and you click on news, it's what's called director's notes. And I use that to communicate with our policy board. But also, those are given to our citizens advisory and technical advisory committees because I'm trying to communicate issues such as like eutrophication, Midnight Pass, climate change to elected officials. And so I'm trying to use language that would be, you know, that my mom would understand. And so, you know, not a scientist. And so what I try to do is try to like make technical information understandable to a wider public. We're not trying to like preach to the choir. We're trying to expand the congregation.
Right.
And so what we're trying to do on that one is describe what we saw with Midnight Pass after Helene. And it's closed already, which is, you know, what a lot of people thought would happen, but it was open. Helene did breach that island roughly where Midnight Pass used to be, and it stayed open for a day or two maybe. Mm-hmm. And so when it was open, there was a good amount of flow that was coming in and out. But I think one of the lessons there is like, you know, if you were to try to reestablish that lost historical tidal connection, even Helene, which has done hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage to our watershed, even that wasn't big enough to create a pass that could last more than a couple of days. Yeah. So it's a real challenge to see whether or not you could do anything that could recreate what Midnight Pass used to be, because Helene couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's going to, I mean, it would be really hard. It's really appealing to get back to the way it was in the 70s. It was very special. But by the 70s, we were already experiencing when the Corps dredged the Intracoastal, it did two things. First, they dumped a lot of sand around the Jim Neville Bird Keys or Jim Neville Preserve, and that probably didn't help. And then by deepening the channels north and south, they probably reduced the tidal prism that would be moving in and out through the pass. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So Peter Sheng did a circulation model, three-dimensional circulation model back in the 90s, and he looked at whether or not the intercoastal waterway was sufficient to destabilize Midnight Pass all by itself. And his answer was he couldn't really answer that, but other people have suggested that it certainly was involved. We know the dredging of Venice Inlet, and we've been dredging in Sarasota Bay for well over 100 years.
Right.
Some of the oldest channels date back to the 1890s.
Right.
But the sort of like reinforced Venice Inlet might have made a more of an influence than the ICW, which is the water draining out of Blackburn Bay goes to the south much quicker. And that looks like the biggest change that took place is not necessarily just the ICW, but Venice Inlet expansion associated with the ICW might have made a lot more water leave to the south rather than, you know, leaving through the old Midnight Pass.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, everything's, you know, we've changed, we've ditched and drained and dredged our bays like crazy. And I can understand the desire to have that tidal circulation. I think there are reasons why getting water to move back and forth makes sense. But if the cure is causing more damage than the problem that it's supposed to address, then it's not going to be an easy thing to permit. I think actually if the county pursues the same pathway they did 15 years ago, it'll never get permitted. The reasons why it got turned down 15 years ago are still relevant.
Yeah, I had served on that original Blue Ribbon Committee, and our recommendation had been to open it in a big way and then leave it alone. The people on the committee liked the idea of a natural pass, and the idea of a miniature Venice Inlet was not appealing. I mean, it might be appealing to boaters, but for many of the people that really enjoyed Little Sarasota Bay and Midnight Pass, it was that it was wild and natural, not that it was stabilized. And so we took that to the county commission like that, and we took it to DEP, and they said, no, we're not going to dredge a pass and leave it alone. It would have to be stabilized. And so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of folks are talking about, let's stabilize the pass, but, you know, look at Venice Inlet, and look how big that beach is north of the inlet, how you don't have a beach south of the inlet.
Right.
Our predominant sand movement along the shoreline is north to south. So if you live on Casey Key, someone puts a new pass there, and like the gentleman who's a PhD PE who gave the presentation to the county, inlets steal sand from the beaches. And it's not stealing, but, you know, the reality is an inlet creates this ebb tidal shoal, which used to be sand that used to, like, move to the south.
Yeah.
So residents on Casey Key who already have their own challenges would have less sand if you create an inlet there. That's just, you know, it may not be what people want to hear, but it's what they need to understand.
When I was still teaching, I took a group of students down to Midnight Beach, and we walked around. I was showing them gopher tortoises and explaining the plants and barrier island dynamics. And then we walked a little further and pointed out Stephen King's house. And this young student got really excited, and she said, oh, I'm going to tell my mother I saw Stephen King's house. So all the natural history and geology and bay management, it was gone. But it was getting to see Stephen King's house. It was a big deal.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
WSLR in Fogartyville is your trusted community resource offering independent news, local music, and arts programming that reflects the diversity of Sarasota. From the airwaves to the stage, we work to amplify the voices of those who make our community unique. Our fall membership drive from October 9th to October 15th is an opportunity for you to support the station that supports you. Whether it's our twice weekly newscasts, local concerts, or community events, your contributions during the drive ensure that WSLR in Fogartyville remains a space where many voices come together to create one vibrant community. What would you like to talk about next, Dave?
Well, one of the things that I think we like to stress to people is that it's, Bay restoration, Bay management isn't just government action. It's like what people can do individually. And so we like to try to tell people, the things you can do to make this bay healthier differ depending upon where you live in the watershed. But like things that make sense everywhere is don't over-fertilize your lawn. Yeah. If you have reclaimed water, don't fertilize at all.
Right.
You don't need it.
Yeah.
And if you have a lawn and you're mowing it yourself, or if someone's mowing it for you, don't blow those grass clippings into the water, into the canal, or into the street.
Yeah.
Because they're just going to go in a storm drain. A lot of our bacteria and a lot of settings that we've sampled are driven by decomposing grass clippings, which can give you very high levels of bacteria. Pick up after your dogs, obviously. And some people say, well, I always pick up after my dog, except in my lawn. Well, after Debbie, guess what? Your lawn is everyone's lawn. And then one of the other things, like particularly in people who live along the water front, is something that we're trying to get a grip on right now is our seawalls are converting from concrete to plastic.
Yeah.
And probably, we're in the early stages of this, but probably one of the best, largest oyster reef kind of habitats is concrete seawalls and the plastic seawalls. And they're actually kind of roughly polyvinyl chloride and fiberglass. Oysters just don't seem to be growing on them. And it could be, it's just going to take a little bit longer, but, we've seen plastic seawalls that are several years old and they've got barnacles on them, but not oysters. And that means you're plastic seawall is actually helping to create worse water quality because oysters have an ability to create habitat, filter water. So if you're living on a finger-filled canal and every one of you and your neighbors are replacing your concrete seawalls with plastic, your water quality is going to be the first one to deteriorate. So we'd like to basically make the case that we have a project with Longboat Key where we're looking at these a company out of Miami that has a 3D printer for concrete seawall panels that go on the outside. And you don't need a permit, apparently, for this because it's not touching the bottom. But these things are creating a fairly lightweight concrete panel on the outside of a plastic seawall that will allow you to have your plastic seawall, but also allow you to have like the concrete base for oysters to grow on. And that's what we're trying to do is like just consider it may cost more money to do a concrete seawall replacement for a failing concrete seawall, but if you and everyone in your canal community goes from concrete to plastic, the first people that are going to be adversely affected by water quality are you and your neighbors.
Yeah,
and it seems like the state is now requiring that dock pilings are wrapped in plastic or vinyl as well, and so that seems ill-fated too, doesn't it? I mean, there used to be oyster colonies growing on every dock piling.
Yeah, and it's one of the it's bay management, water quality management isn't just pollutant loads; it's also assimilative capacity. So if we're removing a lot of our oyster reef, habitat by plastic lined pilings and plastic seawalls, then we're removing like a habitat that actually is helping to improve our water quality. And it's just one of these things that maybe people weren't paying attention to. But if you actually go out on the bay, it's easy to see these things because concrete seawalls are flat. And if you go and get closer to them, you'll see oysters. And if you tap on it with your knuckle, it's concrete.
Uh-huh.
If you go in along the waterfront and you see this kind of like a corduroy looking or kind of grooved looking seawall and there's no oysters on it, it might be bluish, kind of bluish gray look. Some of them are yellowish. And you tap on it with your knuckle, it's plastic.
Yeah.
And there won't be oysters on it. And we don't know why, but we're trying to migrate towards, we're trying to be biased towards action. Rather than spending 5 years to figure out why, we're trying to figure out what to do now.
Yeah.
Can you explain biological oxygen demand? And that is related to leaf litter and stuff flowing into the storm sewer systems.
Yeah, so everything like from like oak pollen to oak leaves to like grass clippings, all of that is carbon and hydrogen or carbon and carbon bonds that are an energy source. And bacteria will break down organic material because that's how they make their living. And as they break it down, they're going to use oxygen as what's called the final electron acceptor. And so what they'll do is not only will you have more bacteria, so the state of Florida has three fecal indicator bacteria, E. coli, Enterococci, and fecal coliform. And none of them are specific to humans or mammals or even animals. You can get all of them from decomposing litter. So we could be chasing after high bacteria that has nothing to do with sewage. It's just decomposing seagrass blades. You have high bacteria off of the Caples campus, Suncoast Waterkeepers. It doesn't mean it's sewage. It could be like the decomposing seagrass meadows from an extensive meadow that's offshore. We don't really know, but it's entirely possible that what you're seeing is elevated bacteria that's natural. But it will decompose oxygen. And I think we have more of a built environment than a natural environment. So the chances are the BOD is driven by grass clippings and oak pollen being not just laying on the ground, but being shunted down the street into the storm drains. And that's another thing, which is it's not really the population growth that's giving us more people out at like Lakewood Ranch. That's not really our big stormwater challenge. Our big stormwater challenge is the older neighborhoods where they never had stormwater rules and regulations.
Yeah, that's right.
So we live in one of those, and we got I guess it was a NOAA grant, and we had, we got people with three types of lawns, like lawns where people did nothing and then sort of intermediate, and one where they had a lawn surface. And we buried open containers in the lawns, and then we had a student that would run around immediately after a rain and take samples from those. And those samples from the lawns that had lawn surface had much, as you might expect, higher nutrient levels.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah, that was a really cool little report. Yeah, a neat study.
It was simple, and you sort of made the point.
Anything else that private individuals can do to protect the base?
I have a private individual story.
Okay, go ahead.
Somebody asked me one time, what is the one thing people could do to improve the quality in the bay? And I said, dig a hole at the bottom of your driveway, put an aquarium in there, put fish in there, and keep them alive. And if you can keep fish alive and what's running off your driveway and your property, then you're doing something for the bay. And they said, well, that's conceptually elegant and totally impractical.
Well, I knew that when I was working, so I've worked about half my career in the private sector, half in the public sector. And one of the things we saw was like there are places that are healthier than you'd expect them to be with the amount of urbanization. And part of it is like if you look around Englewood, there's a lot of old-fashioned like drainage there. So it's basically not like curbs and gutters and pipes that take the water out there. It's swales. So about 20 years ago when we started to do this research into it, you know, we found that Lemon Bay's watershed was not having as big of an impact as we thought. We would basically – it gave rise to this bumper sticker that was called Save the Swales. We thought that was cool.
That's great.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown studios on Kumquat Court.
Today's show, number 46, featured Dr. Dave Tomasco, director of the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program, talking about bay trends and what we know so far about the effects of Hurricane Helene.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on October 15th for the fall membership drive, which will include Rebecca Acosta from the Healthy Living Hour.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
Right now, stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed and played by John Lambie.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, 6 blocks north of Main Street in Sarasota. Dave, once again, how do people get in touch with the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program?
Visit our website, sarasotabay.org. You can click on a tab to volunteer for one of our events. You can click on tabs for just more information. Reach out at info@sarasotabay.org or reach out to myself, dave@sarasotabay.org, email, or Megan, M-E-G-A-N, @sarasotabay.org. And we can get you in touch with volunteer opportunities, gatherings, that sort of stuff.
Fantastic.